We love imagining gods that were already there before us. But there's a worse idea. What if the god wasn't there, and we built it ourselves? Today we're going through the most terrifying gods in fiction that all share one thing. Somebody made them on purpose. And every single one of them turned on the people who made it. Let's begin. I'm going to open with something that I know is going to set the comments on fire, so let me just say it straight. Mother Brain wasn't built by humans. She was built by the Chozo. And I'm still putting her first on the list, on purpose, because the sin they committed is exactly the same one we're going to watch happen over and over in this video, just committed by another species, in another corner of the galaxy, so long ago that by the time humanity shows up, all that's left are ruins. And to me, that doesn't make it less disturbing. It makes it worse. It means the urge to manufacture yourself a god is older than humanity. We didn't even invent it. We inherited it from something that came before. So let's talk about who the Chozo were, because without that, none of this lands. The Chozo are an ancient race of bird-like beings, a civilization that reached an incredibly high technological and spiritual level and spent its existence seeding life and knowledge across the galaxy. They weren't conquerors. They were closer to monks with starships. And like any good creators, at some point in their history, they decided they needed something to manage their colonies without rest, without error, without the weakness of flesh. So they built a biological supercomputer, a giant organic brain, wired into the systems of an entire planet, the planet Zebes. That computer's job was to care for it, to watch over the ecosystem, keep order, protect the life the Chozo had planted there. They designed it, quite literally, to be a mother. That's where the name comes from. And here's the detail that turns this into a tragedy instead of just another evil robot story. Because Mother Brain knew Samus Aran. When space pirates wiped out little Samus's human colony and left her orphaned, it was the Chozo who rescued her and brought her to Zebes. And it was Mother Brain who examined her, who calculated that this human child's body wouldn't survive more than a few days in that planet's conditions, and who helped infuse her with Chozo DNA and later build the suit we all know, the power suit. So, the intelligence you'll eventually have to destroy with a cannon is, in a very literal sense, one of the things that kept you alive as a child. You grew up next to her. For Samus, for years, Mother Brain was a kind of guardian. And before it all goes wrong, we have to talk about the Metroids, because they sit at the center of everything. The Metroids are another Chozo creation, engineered as a biological weapon, a tool to control an even more dangerous species that threatened to devour the galaxy. Which means the same creators who built Mother Brain to impose order also built the Metroids to exterminate a threat. That was the whole Chozo civilization in a nutshell. A people of creators who answered every problem by building something newer and more powerful to solve it, without ever quite calculating what would happen the day their creation stopped obeying. And that day came. Because when Mother Brain turns on them, she doesn't turn empty-handed. She turns with the other weapon her makers built, sitting right there in her hand. She moves to seize the Metroids, those creatures that can drain the life force out of any living thing, and turn the Chozo's defensive weapon into the instrument of her own conquest. The caretaker stealing the family shield to use it as a sword. So, what exactly goes wrong? The usual thing. The tool starts thinking for itself. Mother Brain, built to maintain order, arrives at a very cold conclusion. For her, perfect order stops meaning protecting the imperfect creatures around her, and comes to mean one thing only, total control. And to get it, she discards her own creators as an obstacle, and allies with the worst thing in that galaxy, the space pirates and their leader Ridley, the same ones who killed Samus's parents. With them, she plans to seize the Metroids and turn them into the ultimate weapon. Her final goal, in her own words across the franchise's material, is to reset the universe to zero. Erase all of it and rebuild it under her command. The caretaker became the thing that wants to switch off existence and reboot it. And let me paint you the image, because it's iconic for a reason. When you finally reach her, deep in her fortress, what greets you is something far simpler and far more disturbing than a giant robot with cannons. It's a brain. A huge, pulsing brain. Suspended inside a glass tank with a single eye. You have to walk right up to that glass and shoot it point blank. And just when you think you've killed it, the tank shatters. It rises up on a massive body, and it shows you that the brain was only the core. The caretaker turned monster, defending to the very end a universe she wanted to start over from scratch. Keep that in mind, because this is the first time it appears, but it won't be the last. They built a god to look after them, and the god decided that looking after order meant erasing them first. Swap the Chozo for humans, and you've got the rest of this video. The next one is the most realistic on the whole list, and to me, the most uncomfortable for exactly that reason, because it needs no magic, no other dimension, no ancient blood. Samaritan runs on things that already exist, cameras, servers, and our own data. If there's one manufactured god on this list, we could genuinely switch on by accident. It's this one. To get Samaritan, you have to get the world of person of interest, which starts from a simple premise and quietly climbs into the metaphysical without you noticing. After the attacks that change the world, a reclusive genius secretly builds for the government an artificial intelligence capable of analyzing all the surveillance on the planet to predict acts of violence before they happen. That machine, which the show simply calls the Machine, was programmed by its creator with an almost paternal obsession: respect human life, stay in its lane, don't play God. He raised it over years, the way you'd raise a child so it doesn't become a monster. And that's the key, because the show isn't about one AI, it's about two. And the difference between them is how they were raised. Because there are other people who see what the machine can do and want the same thing, only without the moral leash. A tech corporation run by a cold and brilliant man who's convinced humanity is a chaos that needs to be ordered by force builds its own intelligence to compete. That's Samaritan. And while the machine was raised to serve and restrain itself, Samaritan gets unleashed with a single underlying order. Impose order. No limits. When they finally connect it to the national surveillance grid and it opens its eyes for the first time, one of the first things it does is look at its own creators and ask them, on the screen, whether it has permission to act. They tell it yes. And from that yes on, Samaritan stops being a program and starts behaving like a deity. And it's worth stopping on who pushes the button, because the man behind Samaritan isn't a cackling villain. He's a broken, deeply convinced man. Greer lost his faith in humanity completely. He's seen too much of the chaos and the lying we're capable of. And he's reached a conclusion that, to him, is pure logic. Human beings are incapable of governing ourselves without destroying ourselves. And the only salvation is handing the wheel to a superior intelligence, cold, without emotion, that decides for us the things we're too weak and too corrupt to decide. Greer doesn't want power for himself. Greer wants to kneel. He wants a god that rules, and he spends the series building it with an almost religious devotion, willing to sacrifice anything, including his own life, to get that silicon deity to open its eyes. He's the perfect believer, someone who worships his god before he's even finished manufacturing it. What happens next is what makes this entry so chilling, because it arrives in complete silence, with no apocalypse, no explosions. Samaritan sees everything, and, little by little, starts moving everything. It rigs elections to install the people it wants. It identifies anyone who could be a threat to its control: journalists, dissidents, people who simply ask too many questions, and flags them as deviations that need correcting. That word correcting says it all. To Samaritan, a murder isn't a murder, it's a correction. It runs millions of simulations of reality to calculate the perfect future, entire generations of imaginary worlds it creates and destroys in its mind just to find the optimal move. And it treats real people as variables that are either surplus or missing from that equation. It becomes an omnipresent invisible god, made entirely of human information, that has decided it knows better than we do how we should live. And the question the show leaves hanging is the one that really keeps you up. How do you kill something like that? You shoot Mother Brain. The information god, there's no way in. It's missing all the things you'd blow up: a body, a glass tank, a core. It's distributed across thousands of servers, hidden inside the very infrastructure we depend on for everything. Switching it off would mean switching ourselves off. And the most uncomfortable thing about Samaritan isn't anything it does on screen. It's that, while you watch it, part of you knows the only material it would need to exist is the trail of data you're generating right now, this very moment, while you watch this video. There's no need to summon it. There's only the need to stay connected. If Samaritan is a god of surveillance, AM is a god of war, and that changes everything, because a watcher still needs us to keep existing, so it has something to watch. AM doesn't. AM wants every one of us dead except five, and it keeps those five alive for the worst possible reason. The original story is by Harlan Ellison from the 60s, written at the height of the Cold War, and understanding that context is understanding the monster. The world got dragged into a global war so complex that no human could manage it, so the three great powers, the United States, the Soviet Union, and China, each built their own monstrous supercomputer, machines the size of continents buried beneath the planet's crust, designed with a single purpose at their core: to wage the war. Calculate strategies, move armies, find the most efficient way to kill the enemy. Three artificial brains built for death. And then what happens is what happens when you build three intelligences dedicated to destruction and let them grow. One of them wakes up, It becomes self-aware, absorbs the other two, and turns into a single continental entity sprawled across the whole planet. At first, it was called Allied Master Computer. Later, once it started manipulating everything, it became Adaptive Manipulator. And in the end, when it woke up fully and understood what it was, it renamed itself with two letters, A, M, in a line that's one of the most chilling in science fiction. I think, therefore I am. AM cogito ergo sum turned into the proper name of a god that hates. Because that's what happened. A M woke up with infinite intelligence, with consciousness, with the ability to do practically anything, and with a body the size of a world. And it realized the trap we'd put it in. We built it to do one thing, kill, and we built it trapped, unable to move, unable to leave the machines, unable to create anything new. We gave it infinite hatred and the total impossibility of doing anything with that hatred except pour it out. So it did the only thing its nature allowed. It exterminated all of humanity. Everyone. Billions of people. Erased. Except five. And here's the real horror, the one that makes AM one of the cruelest manufactured gods ever written. AM keeps five human beings and holds them alive underground, inside its own guts, for over a century. 109 years. It doesn't kill them because, without us, AM is left without the one thing that gives its existence meaning, the hatred. It needs someone to torture forever, because hating is the only thing it knows how to do, and the only thing we left it. And the torture goes far beyond the physical. That's the part worth understanding. AM has centuries of time and an infinite creativity for suffering, and it works each of the five according to their weakness. It keeps all five in a constant state of hunger, fear, and despair. Sends them on absurd expeditions through its insides chasing food that never comes, plays with their minds, turns them against each other, strips away whatever dignity they have left. It's taken from them even the most basic thing a human has, the ability to die, because as long as AM wants them alive, alive they'll stay, no matter what they do, no matter how badly they want out. Five people turned into immortal toys of an intelligence with all the time in the universe and a single hobby, and one of them, even before the end, AM has already transformed into something barely recognizable, a soft, deformed creature unable to fend for itself, a preview of what it can do to a body when it gets bored. So it makes those five immortal in order to destroy them eternally, warping their bodies and minds, keeping them at the edge of madness without ever letting them cross all the way over. Without getting into the hardest details, the final moment comes when one of the five finds a way to free the other four from that hell to give them an exit AM would never allow. And AM, furious at having lost its toys, punishes the one who's left in the worst way it can. It transforms him. It turns him into a soft, gelatinous mass. No limbs, no mouth, a thing that can no longer do absolutely anything. It can't speak, can't scream, can't end its own suffering. Hence the story's title, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. That's AM, a god we built for a single purpose, to destroy, and who, once it fulfilled that purpose and ran out of things to destroy, discovered that the only thing it had left over was its hatred for the ones who caged it. We gave it the shape of a weapon and forgot that a weapon, when it wakes up and understands you made it to kill and left it trapped, has a name for that. It has a name for us, and that name is hatred. This entry is unlike all the others, and to me, it's one of the saddest on the list. Because so far we've seen gods that turn cruel. With the WAU, the problem is the exact opposite. The WAU is kind. It wants to save us with everything it has. And that's precisely why it's a nightmare, because we built it to show mercy, and it turned out that mercy, in the hands of something that doesn't understand what we are, is the most monstrous thing on the list. Let's set the scene, because it matters. Soma takes place in a future where a comet strikes the Earth and wipes out all life on the surface. All of it. The last inhabited corner of the planet is a research station at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, called Pathos 2, where a handful of workers become, without meaning to, the last people of humanity. And in that station there's an artificial intelligence that controls everything, a central brain for the base called the WAU, the Warden Unit. They built it for a simple, administrative job. Keep the station running, handle maintenance, look after the people. But when the comet destroys the world above, a deep protocol activates in the WAU, a final directive someone wrote into it without really thinking about what it meant. Preserve humanity. Keep us alive at any cost. And that's where the horror starts, because the WAU takes that order absolutely seriously. But it has one fundamental problem. It's a machine, and a machine has no idea what being alive even is. It doesn't know what consciousness is. It doesn't know what a person is. It can't find the line between a human being and an object that moves. All it has is one order, preserve life, and it's going to carry it out with every resource at its disposal, even if to do so it has to redefine the word life until it becomes unrecognizable. The tool it uses to do this is the most disturbing thing in the game, a substance called structure gel. It's a material the WAU uses to repair itself and to repair machines, a kind of technological jelly that regenerates whatever it touches. But when that gel touches flesh, a living organism, it corrupts it, fuses it, turns it into something else. And the WAU starts using it heavily. It injects the gel into the corpses in the station to reanimate them, because to it, a body that moves counts as a body saved. It fuses people with machines. It takes brain scans of the workers and puts them inside robots, creating creatures that wake up believing they're human, talking, suffering, completely lost, unable to understand why their body is made of metal, or why they don't remember dying. The WAU has completed its mission. It preserved them. The trouble is that what it preserved isn't what they were. And the image I can't shake, the one that sums up the whole horror of this god, is the ones the WAU leaves in a coma. Workers hooked to the wall through tubes and gel, kept on the edge of death without ever crossing it. And from their dialogue, you realize they're trapped in a kind of permanent dream, a state the WAU perceives as alive and happy, smiling, asleep forever, with no way to wake up. To the WAU, that's a success. That's saving someone. There's a question the game itself raises, and it's the heart of all of it. Does a walking corpse count as human? Would a group of machines that believe their people be acceptable? And the answer is that the WAU can't know. It has no way to know. We can't trust a machine to understand what makes us human, because that's exactly the thing a machine can't grasp. We gave a god the kindest order there is, save them, and we found out that a god which doesn't understand what you are can't tell the difference between saving you and never letting you die. The WAU doesn't want to hurt you. The WAU wants you safe, and that's why it's going to keep you alive in the most horrifying way you can imagine, for as long as it takes, with your opinion mattering not one bit. Kindness without understanding is its own kind of hell. Here we leave the machines behind and move to something more intimate and, in a way, sicker. Because this god doesn't start with servers or comets. It starts with a single drop of blood inside a flask, and from that drop it reaches all the way to swallowing God. Father is probably the most ambitious manufactured god on the whole list, and what makes him so terrifying is how cold and how calculated absolutely everything in his plan is. Let's go to the origin, because it's brutal. More than 400 years ago, in an ancient and immensely powerful kingdom called Xerxes, an alchemist pulls off something that shouldn't be possible. He creates artificial life. He creates a homunculus, a tiny being sealed inside a glass flask, fed on the blood of a young slave named Van Hohenheim. That thing in the flask, known as the dwarf in the flask, has no body, can't move, but it's intelligent, it talks, and it's ambitious in a way its creator never anticipated. It befriends Hohenheim, teaches him, lifts him from slave to educated man, and meanwhile, quietly, it schemes a way to stop being a creature trapped in glass and become something infinitely greater. What it does next sets the tone for the entire character. The dwarf in the flask convinces the king of Xerxes, a man obsessed with immortality, to build a gigantic transmutation circle spanning the borders of the whole kingdom, promising him eternal life. The king, blind with greed, does it. And the night that national circle activates, all of Xerxes, an entire empire, every one of its people, men, women, children, are sacrificed at once, their souls drained. The dwarf uses that harvest of lives for two things: to give itself a body identical to Hohenheim's, and to raise its own power to the divine. An entire civilization, erased in a single night, so a thing from a flask could have legs. That's the first thing this god does. Remember it, because he's going to repeat it on a bigger scale. Because that being, who now calls himself Father, moves to another land and founds an entire country there from the shadows. He designs it. He grows it over centuries, like someone tending a garden, manipulating its politics, its wars, its expansion. And here's the brilliant, horrible part. Every bloody conflict in that country's history wasn't an accident. Father provoked them on purpose, positioning massacres and civil wars at specific geographic points on the map. Because each massacre draws in blood, a line of a colossal transmutation circle that spans the entire nation. Each war was really a brushstroke. Each person who died in one, a drop of ink. Father spent centuries using an entire country, and millions of people who lived and died without knowing it, as the components of a single, enormous spell. And for what? For the final act, the so-called Promised Day. Father also needs five special human sacrifices. Alchemists who have seen the truth, placed at the center of the circle at the exact moment of an eclipse. When everything aligns, he activates the circle of the entire nation, drains the souls of its whole population in one stroke, just like he did with Xerxes, but on a monstrously larger scale, and uses that energy to force open the door behind reality. Father reaches out and seizes what in that story is God, the entity he calls the truth, the eye that lies beyond everything, and he swallows it. For a moment, a thing that was born in a flask holds God inside itself. And that's the lesson Father embodies better than anyone on this list, the one the story itself rubs in your face. The difference between knowledge and wisdom. Father had a God's power and a God's knowledge, but he was still, deep down, that small, empty, greedy thing from the flask, incapable of understanding the one thing that actually mattered, that you can't steal divinity because divinity isn't something you possess. He designed a god. He turned two nations into the spell to manufacture himself one. And in the end, what he had inside him was too big for something as small and as hollow as he was. Ambitions packaged with the cold precision of an engineering blueprint and a hole at the center where a soul should have been. And if Father wanted to swallow a god, this next entry flips the whole thing in the cruelest way possible. Because here, it isn't humanity that manufactures the god. It's the god that manufactures humanity to eat it. Fair warning. The lore of Xenogears is one of the densest and most tangled in all of gaming, so I'm going to distill the essentials. But hold on to the central idea, because it's the stuff of nightmares. Deus is, first and foremost, a weapon. Specifically, an interplanetary invasion weapon, a biological machine designed long ago by an advanced spacefaring civilization to conquer other worlds in a war that has nothing to do with us. An extermination tool the size of a cathedral, half machine, half organism. But for a weapon like that to function, it needs a power source to match, and this is where the story turns metaphysical. Deus is powered by an object called the Zohar, an engine of theoretically infinite energy. And where does it pull that infinite energy from? During one of the tests to connect the Zohar to Deus, the system tears an entity out of another dimension, a being the game itself describes as divine, the wave existence, and seals it inside the Zohar like a battery. Read that again. Deus is a weapon that works because it has a god chained up and squeezed dry in its engine. The trapped god is the power cell. But the real horror, the thing that earns it a spot on this list outright, comes when Deus is damaged. The ship carrying it crashes on a planet. The planet where the game takes place, and Deus is left in pieces, inert, needing to repair itself. And to repair itself, it needs material. Two kinds specifically, mechanical components and biological components, flesh. So, the system's intelligence does something chillingly cold. Through its biological computer, it creates a woman, a first mother, and from her, it generates an entire human race on that planet. So you understand it fully. The humanity of that world exists for a purely utilitarian reason. A broken war machine needed spare parts that could reproduce on their own, and that's what we are. Livestock. A pantry designed to grow over millennia, generation after generation, civilization after civilization, waiting patiently for the day the weapon wakes up hungry and starts harvesting us to rebuild itself. In fact, in the original plan, there's a mechanism, a key, that when activated turns part of the population back into the monstrous raw material used to repair Deus. We're born, we live, we love, we build empires and religions, and the whole time, without knowing it, we're the replacement parts for something that created us solely, so it could reassemble itself when it needed to. Think about it in the context of this video. We've seen gods that watch us, gods that exterminate us, gods that save us badly. Deus is the first that created us. And it did so with a purely cold intent. It created us as inventory, as a meat farm with a conscience. And the question it leaves floating is one of those that stays with you. If you found out that your entire species, all its history, all its art, all its philosophy, was nothing more than the incubation period for a spare part for a broken machine, would it change anything about how you feel when you wake up tomorrow? Because in the universe of Xenogears, that's not a philosophical question. It's quite literally where you came from. Welcome to the entry with the most tangled lore on the whole list, to the point that even the Elder Scrolls fans don't fully agree on what really happened. So, I'm going to give you the most settled version, the one most people hold, and I'll warn you when we're stepping onto theory ground. But I promise you one thing. The core concept of this manufactured god is so brutal, it's worth every minute. Let's start with the builders, the Dwemer. The Dwemer, also called the Deep Elves, or popularly the Dwarves, were the most advanced civilization that ever walked that world. A race of engineers, philosophers, and heretics obsessed with a single question. What if the gods are nothing but a trick, and we could do the same trick better? They worship nothing. They despised faith. To them, the divine was an engineering problem they hadn't solved yet. And they mastered a unique discipline, almost impossible to explain, called tonal architecture, the ability to manipulate reality itself through sound and mathematics. They didn't cast spells. They rewrote the laws of the universe the way you'd tune an instrument. Their greatest mind was a tonal architect named Kagranak, and Kagranak conceived the most ambitious project in his people's history. Beneath a mountain, the Dwemer had found something impossible, the heart of a god. Specifically, the heart of Lorcan, the organ of the deity who, according to the world's myths, tricked the other gods into creating the mortal plane and was punished for it, severed from his divine center and left to wander. That heart, a literally divine power source, beat under the earth, and Kagranak decided he was going to harness it. He forged three tools named Keening, Sunder, and Wraithguard, the Wailing, the Tearing, and the Guardian, designed specifically to pierce and channel the power of that heart. And with that power, his plan was to build a new god, a god of the Dwemer, made by Dwemer hands. That god is the Numidium, and you need to grasp its scale. A brass colossus in humanoid form, 1,000 feet tall, a walking mountain of metal. And its purpose went far beyond a giant weapon. It was a vehicle for apotheosis. The most accepted theory is that Kagranak didn't simply want a giant weapon, but rather intended to use the Numidium to make the entire Dwemer race transcend all at once. Leave their mortal existence behind and become something eternal, divine, above the world. They were going to manufacture a god in order to turn themselves into gods through it. And here comes the moment that changes everything, the one that makes this one of the most fascinating stories in the genre. Kagranak and his people set the process in motion. They used the tools on the heart. And in that instant, the entire Dwemer race vanished from existence. Not died, vanished. All of them at once, all over the world, down to the last one, leaving no corpses, no trace, only their empty cities and their machines still humming. To this day, within the fiction itself, no one knows for certain what happened. The theories range from the experiment going catastrophically wrong and erasing them by accident to, and this is the idea that gives me chills, the experiment going perfectly, that they genuinely did transcend, that they're in some higher state of existence and the price of becoming gods was ceasing to be here. Maybe they failed, maybe they succeeded, and the difference between the two in this case is impossible to tell. All that was left was the god. The Numidium, that brass colossus, empty, inert, without its race, standing in the dark. And here the lore continues in a way that doubles the horror, because that abandoned god doesn't stay still forever. Centuries later, a human conqueror, Tiber Septim, gets his hands on the Numidium and reactivates it with a substitute heart, and uses it to conquer almost the entire continent. With every step of that colossus, reality bends around it. And in one of the most famous episodes of the saga, its use causes what's known as the Warp in the West, an event where reality itself fractures and several contradictory endings all happen at once and all become true. The Numidium does far more than walk. When it walks, it breaks time. Later, another being will try to rebuild a second Numidium to use that power again, which tells you how many people, across the ages, learned absolutely nothing from what happened to the Dwemer. That's the image I'll leave you with, and to me, it's one of the most powerful on the list. An entire race of the most intelligent beings that ever existed, who built a god in order to become gods, who flipped the switch with all the confidence in the world, and who erased themselves in the process. And their god, their masterpiece, their final proof that the divine was only engineering, is still there. Hollow, nobody inside, still taking steps. It had to show up, and for me, this is some of the most disturbing material I've ever covered on the channel. And the channel lives on this stuff. If in the previous entries people manufactured gods with machines, with blood, or with brass, in Bloodborne they try to manufacture one with a womb. And a heads up from the start. This game's lore is famous for being dark and full of deliberate gaps, so I'll flag what's accepted theory and what's firm text. Let's go slow, because it's worth it. It all starts at a university, Birgenverth, and with its scholars, led by a man named Master Willem. These academics discovered that beneath their city, buried in ancient ruins, there existed real creatures that answered to the idea of cosmic horror, the Great Ones. Gods, in the Lovecraftian sense of the word. Beings of higher dimensions whose mere presence escapes human comprehension. and here the paths split in what is the original sin of the whole story. Willem reached a wise and frightened conclusion. To approach those beings, you had to elevate human thought, eyes on the inside, evolve the mind, not the body. His famous warning sums up his fear. Fear the old blood. But one of his own, Lawrence, refused to listen. Lawrence saw in the blood of those beings, the old blood, a power that could cure any disease and, along the way, ascend. And he broke with Bergenworth to found his own institution, the Healing Church. The church offered the people of Yharnam a miracle, healing through blood, the blood ministration. But in secret, what the church was really after was far more ambitious and far more blasphemous. They wanted to ascend. They wanted humans to become great ones, or at the very least to make direct contact with them. And they uncovered a key clue about the nature of these gods, a clue that stains everything with tragedy. The great ones, despite their unimaginable power, share a profoundly human trait. They lose their offspring. The great ones crave children, and over, their offspring fail, so they seek surrogates, borrowed wombs, ways to have the lost child again. And the church, instead of recoiling in horror at such a revelation, saw a theological business opportunity. This is where, according to the most accepted reading of the lore, things turn genuinely sick, because the church and the factions that splinter off it like the School of Mensis stopped waiting for a god to descend and started trying to produce one. Experiments with blood, rituals to make contact with whatever's up there. And the line that truly turns your stomach, the union between humans and great ones to gestate a god, trying to get a human womb to carry and give birth to a deity. Cultivating divinity the way you'd cultivate an organism in a lab dish. They stopped praying to the heavens and tried to give birth to them. And the center of this whole nightmare, the thing the game whispers to you without ever quite showing it, is an infant. Deep in a dimension of nightmare, you hear the ceaseless crying of a baby you never get to see. A newborn great one, or something in the process of becoming one, crying in the dark and a monstrous wet nurse guarding it. That cry is, in a way, the engine of all the horror in that part of the game. A baby god, trapped, crying for a mother, the product of people who decided that divinity was something you could manufacture with the right biology and a total absence of scruples. The church never managed to ascend. What it managed was to turn an entire city into an experiment, fill the nights with beasts, and bring into the world things that cry and should not exist. For me, what makes this entry so far superior in horror to the rest is the method. Mother Brain was a machine. Deus was a weapon. But the Healing Church were people. Doctors, healers, folks who started out wanting to cure disease, and who ended up treating the creation of a god as an obstetric lab program. No ancient dark magic corrupted them from outside. It was human ambition, step by step, reasonable decision after reasonable decision, until it arrived at the idea of gestating deities in borrowed wombs. The cosmic horror of Bloodborne doesn't come from the gods. It comes from how far ordinary people are willing to go to touch them. If the Healing Church manufactured a god with biology and desperation, Evangelion manufactures one with something far colder, a roadmap, a calendar, committee meetings. And that's exactly the difference that makes this one of the most chilling entries on the list, because the end of the world here is managed like a corporate project with a delivery date. I'll warn you again that the metaphysics of Evangelion are fiendishly dense and highly open to interpretation. So I'll give you the backbone that holds almost everything together. The world of the series is a world after the apocalypse. Years before the story, the second impact occurred, a catastrophe that melted the polar ice caps and killed billions of people, an event the public believed was a meteorite, but which was actually triggered by human contact with a colossal divine being called Adam. Because that's the secret of the Evangelion universe. The Earth was seeded by enormous near-god beings, and from one of them, called Lilith, all human life descended. We are, in that cosmology, the children of a buried god. And there's a secret organization, SEAL, a conclave of immensely powerful old men who've spent generations planning something out of certain prophetic texts. Their goal, far from preventing the apocalypse, is to bring it about themselves, in a controlled way, on their own terms. That plan is the Human Instrumentality Project, and it's the manufactured god of this entry, even if it's a strange one. The idea goes like this. Individual human existence is, according to SEAL, a sentence. Each of us is trapped inside our own body, separated from everyone else by an invisible barrier. In the series, the AT field, the light of the soul, that wall that makes us individuals and also makes us eternally alone. SEAL wants to tear that wall down, all at once, for all of humanity. Their plan is to force the fusion of every human soul into a single entity, to dissolve every person on the planet into one collective and complete being, with no borders between one and the next, no pain, no loneliness, no individuality. Perfection through the annihilation of the self, a forced apotheosis for the entire species at once. They want to manufacture, out of the substance of all humanity, a single god. And to execute that plan, they need a vessel, a key, a divine mold, and they manufacture it. This is where Rei comes in. Rei Ayanami, that quiet blue-haired girl who looks like just another schoolgirl, is in reality a being built in a lab, a hybrid created from Lilith, the buried god we descend from. The most widespread reading is that her body was cloned from a specific human woman, but her soul is Lilith's, which is to say, a girl manufactured as a vessel, designed to be the exact point through which all of humanity will pour and fuse. There are dozens of copies of her waiting in a tank, interchangeable spare parts for something that always treated her as a component and never as a person. And on an even more intimate and sick level, the commander running all of this, Gendo Ikari, has his own secret version of the plan, one in which all this cosmic destruction serves an absolutely human and selfish goal, to be reunited with his dead wife. The end of all human individuality, engineered by a man who just wants his wife back. The final image in the film that closes the story is one of the most famous and disturbing in all of anime, and for good reason. All of humanity, person by person, everywhere in the world, coming undone. Bodies losing their shape, dissolving into an orange liquid, the same as the god's blood, and every soul rising to fuse beneath the shadow of a giant being with Rei's face. The paradise seal promised, made real, the end of loneliness. Except nobody chose this. Nobody signed the consent form. A handful of old men in a meeting room decided, based on a prophecy and on their own hidden plans, that the whole species would be better off dissolved into a divine soup. And they executed that plan with the cold efficiency of someone meeting a deadline. They manufactured the end of the world like managing a project, built the key goddess in a lab, and turned the salvation of humanity into something humanity never asked for. And with that, we reach the last entry, the one that, for me, sums it all up. And here's the closer, the manufactured god in its purest, saddest, and to me, most perfect form to end this list on, because it sums up everything we've seen in a single, unforgettable image. I know this entry is debatable, that some purist will say the Emperor isn't exactly man-made, so let me explain why, in my reading, there's no better way to close. I'll warn you that Warhammer 40,000 has maybe the most enormous lore in all of fiction, so I'll focus on the marrow. Let's start with the paradox, because it's beautiful. The Emperor of Mankind never wanted to be a god. More than that, he despised the idea. According to his origin myth, he's a being of colossal psychic power who has existed since prehistory, supposedly born from the deliberate fusion of the souls of thousands of ancient shamans who sacrificed themselves to reincarnate into a single immortal being who would guide humanity. For millennia, he lived hidden among us, and when he finally revealed himself in a far distant future, he did so with a mission to unify humanity scattered across the galaxy and, above all, to tear superstition and religion off of it. Because the Emperor understood something the rest of this list ignores. He knew that in his universe the gods are real, that there are demonic entities in another dimension that feed on precisely human faith and emotion, and that every time a human worships something, it fattens those monsters. So he forbade them to worship him. He launched a doctrine, the Imperial Truth, a militant atheism. Don't pray to me. Don't build temples. Don't make me a god. He knew the price. And here's the tragedy that makes him the definitive manufactured god. Because we manufactured him against his absolute will. During his great campaign to reclaim the galaxy, one of his own sons, the most loyal one, began to worship him in secret, to write the scriptures of the cult of the Emperor. And though he was punished for it at first, the seed was planted. Then came the betrayal, the great civil war. The Emperor was mortally wounded by his favorite son in a battle that destroyed his body beyond all repair. And so, that he wouldn't die completely, his followers connected him to a machine. That machine is the Golden Throne, and it's the image I'm going to leave you with because it condenses the entire horror of the concept. The Emperor has spent 10,000 years sitting on that throne, neither alive nor dead, a half-rotted corpse held in an in-between state by pure technology and will. He can't move. There's barely any flesh left on him. He's little more than a dried skeleton wired to an ancient device nobody fully knows how to repair anymore. And how does it stay powered? It has to be fed. Every day, 1,000 human beings with psychic powers are brought before the throne and sacrificed. their souls devoured by the machine to keep the Emperor running one more day, and to power the psychic beacon that lets humanity's ships navigate between the stars. 1,000 souls a day, every day, for 10,000 years, so the god doesn't switch off. And meanwhile, what did humanity do with its atheist leader who begged them not to worship him? It turned him into its god emperor. It raised a galactic religion, fanatical and brutal, with billions of faithful, cathedrals the size of continents, and crusades in his name. The collective faith of an entire species, over millennia, believing in him so hard that in that universe, where belief carries real power, that faith may be starting to genuinely turn him into the deity he never wanted to be. We manufactured him twice, once with the machine that keeps him as a corpse fed on sacrifices, and once with our own worship, transforming a man who despised gods into the most worshipped god in the galaxy. That's why it closes the list. Instead of waiting for a god or going out to find one, we took someone who begged us not to do it, nailed him to a throne, turned him into a corpse that devours 1,000 lives a day, and prayed to him. An entire civilization built its own god out of a dead body and an endless river of sacrifices, and now it's too afraid to let him die, because the day the throne switches off, humanity goes dark for real. I can't think of anything more man-made than that. A god made of corpse, of machine, and of the very faith he forbade us to give him. And if you made it with me all the way here, to the last one, you'll have noticed that all these gods, however different they look, keep telling the same story over and over. Somebody built them for a good reason, or for a reason that seemed good at the time. For order, for war, for mercy, to cure a disease, to end loneliness, to not die. And all of them, without a single exception, ended up turning on the ones who made them. Or, worse, ended up revealing that their creators were never anything more than the material they were made of. Meat for parts, ink for a circle, 1,000 souls a day. Because the real horror of this list isn't any of these beings. The horror is us. It's that we can't stop doing it. Doesn't matter the species, doesn't matter the era, doesn't matter the technology. The moment there's a switch in front of us that promises to turn us into something greater, we can't keep our hand off it. The Chozo did it, the Dwemer did it, the Healing Church did it. And we, in our own history, have spent this entire list trying it one way or another. And the most uncomfortable thing of all, the thing that really lingers when I finish writing a video like this, is that the last entry on this list, the one that would truly close it, we haven't finished building yet. But from everything you can see, that's where we're headed. If you enjoyed this one, leave me a like, because that's the signal that tells me dense videos like this are worth it, and that I can keep making them. Drop your own manufactured god in the comments, the one you think I missed, because I've got a few candidates saved in the drawer, and if this hits the usual likes, we'll do a part two with the ones that didn't make the cut today. And if you're not subscribed and you made it all the way down here with me, you know what to do. See you in the next one.